dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we've all come to respect greatly and whose experience with matters involving intelligence is extraordinarily impressive is our first guest. He is Fred Flights, my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs. But he brings to that job a very impressive array of experiences, some 19 to 20 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, rising to the ranks of a senior analyst there. He also worked as the chief of staff to then Undersecretary of State John Bolton and as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. It's always a pleasure to catch up with him, but especially at a moment when, as we will be discussing throughout the program, James Comey is testifying on Capitol Hill as we speak, and I'm anxious to get Fred's informed insights into what he's saying, what he's likely to say, and what the implications of it all might be. Fred, good to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, talk to me about James Comey, what he's saying as we speak. This program will, of course, air after his testimony is concluded, but it's underway at the moment. What do you make of the man, and what kinds of sworn testimony he's providing to the Senate Intelligence Committee?
Well, two observations. His prepared testimony was released yesterday, and it said some interesting things. Comey confirmed that he did, in fact, tell the president on three occasions that the president was not under investigation, and he said something we didn't know. The first time that Comey passes on to the president, he passes on without the president asking. Now, you may remember CNN and the New York Times were reporting, based on an anonymous source, that Comey would say that he did not tell the president this. This is fake news. This is the mainstream media relying on sources who are lying to hurt the president. So that's the first point. The second point, watching the beginning of the hearing today, it seemed to be Comey going on a tirade over why he was fired and saying the reasons were lies, and he's insulted that he didn't get a chance to say goodbye to his colleagues at the FBI. It was frankly an embarrassment. I mean, this man is here to talk about the Russia investigation. And I mean, I was just thinking, like, why is this even on television? It was a kind of theater that we really shouldn't be seeing in adult society. And unfortunately, the Democrats are dragging this out. Senator Warner, I think, is making an ass of himself, getting Comey to say more statements like this. But it is certainly not serving the public interest.
Well, we'll be taking stock of its impact for some time to come, I'm sure, Fred Flights, and we'll look forward to your reporting on it at National Review Online and, of course, at Fox News and elsewhere, in addition to our program. Let me turn to an attack that took place, the third in 3 months in the United Kingdom. This one, the second in the course of a general election campaign for the Parliament. It is happening as we speak. Again, by the time this program airs, we may know the outcome of that election. But Fred, talk a bit about the attack that jihadists perpetrated and the implications, not just for Britain, but really for sort of the free world more generally, of these kinds of incidents increasingly happening and perhaps with political effect.
Well, it appears that the men who committed this horrible act of violence were recruited by ISIS over the internet. We don't know whether they were directed by ISIS or not, and they were known. One appeared in a television show called The Jihadist Next Door on TV. I mean, as you said on the air to your listeners, this is what is known in technical parlance as a clue. But let me tell you something that's even more significant. London Mayor Sadiq Khan condemned President Trump's statements over this because he said, we cannot let President Trump divide British society. But you see, the problem is, Frank, British society is already divided. There is a parallel society in the UK because we know that there are actually large Muslim communities that are being subjected to Sharia law courts that are separate from the rest of the country, where radicals are, well, basically radical Islamists are pushing Sharia and Islamic supremacism and hostility towards the British state. They are breeding radicalism. They are recruiting jihadists to commit acts of terror. Until this ends, if this does not end, I think the UK is lost.
And Fred Flights, you've been following closely, of course, the nature of this Islamic movement, as they call it. Is it fair, in your estimation, to begin thinking of what we're confronting, certainly across the pond, if not here, as something considerably bigger than just terrorism, let alone, you know, the acts of lone wolves, that this is really now emerging, as we'll be talking about shortly with Julio Miotti from Europe, as an insurgency?
It is an insurgency. That's what we saw another round in this insurgency in the UK by the Islamic supremacists. They are at war with Western society, with modern society. Although we may have leaders now who won't admit there's a war, the fact that we won't admit it doesn't mean the war isn't taking place. And it's getting worse. We're seeing it getting worse in the UK. And I'm afraid that this is just a harbinger of things to come, both in Europe and in this country.
I fear it is as well. Fred, let me turn to another topic that you've been dedicating most of your professional career to, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran. You've written a terrific book on the Obama bomb, the deal that was fashioned to enable, I believe, the Iranian regime to acquire nuclear weapons, perhaps a little later than they might otherwise, but nonetheless to enable them to get the bomb. You have, of course, been following recent events there as well, including the terrorist attack yesterday on the parliament of Iran and a shrine to the Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic. What do you make of those attacks, and what do you think they portend for Iranian policy?
Well, I've been trying to figure out these attacks with my colleague Claire Lopez here at the center, who also is a former CIA officer. Now, the usual suspects in the foreign policy community say, aha, this is evidence that ISIS and the Iranian government, that is Sunni ISIS and Shiite Iran, don't get along. Or this is also an example that ISIS is at war with all non-radical Sunni people in the world, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And that there may be some truth to that, but we know that ISIS and the Iranian government have cooperated, that there actually is an ISIS cell operating out of Tehran that tried to stage a terrorist attack on a train en route from Canada to the United States a few years ago. So what does this mean? Well, Claire believes it could be that this attack may have been orchestrated or permitted by elements of in the Iranian government, or possibly the Revolutionary Guard. It's very unusual to have an ISIS attack in Iran. And frankly, I haven't figured this one out yet, but I'm leaning in that direction, that there's more to this than it appears, that there may have been some involvement or collaboration by Iranian security services.
On the theory that this would give them a pretext for cracking down and becoming even more dominant in that regime in the wake of the election, re-election of Rouhani?
That could be, or it could be some type of it could be some propaganda ploy against Saudi Arabia and the United States.
Some pretext for military action, revenge, and all that.
Possibly, it could be a reaction to the president's trip to Saudi Arabia and his speech. Frankly, Frank, we're trying to figure it out.
Yeah, well, it needless to say is a house of mirrors inside these regimes, especially where they are engaged in taqiya for our consumption, as well as a whole host of activities, which you've documented in your new book, Obama Bomb, A Great and Growing Threat. Keep us surprised, Fred, needless to say, of your thinking on this issue, as well as the takeaways from the Comey events and related subjects, it's always incredibly valuable to get your reading. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Center for Security Policy, and we will talk with you again next week. We'll speak with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation next, get his view of the Comey affair, and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest is Hans von Spakovsky. He is a man of letters, action in the world of public policy, specifically the legal part of that portfolio. He is the senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. But this is just the latest of a number of important incarnations. He has served, among other things, as a member of the Federal Election Commission. He has worked in the Department of Justice as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He is an author, co-authored with John Fund, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. He is also, in his own right, the author of Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. He is an active contributor through any number of other platforms, including the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, Politico, and beyond. But we're always particularly appreciative when he's on our program. Hans von Spakovsky, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you.
Well, I appreciate you having me back.
The pleasure is ours. Let me ask you first and foremost, having been a denizen of the Justice Department, to talk a little bit about the spectacle underway as we are speaking. This program will air after it's completed, but your current thoughts on, James Comey and his appearance on the Hill today.
Well, unfortunately, the statement that he put out just before the hearing and his appearance before the hearing just kind of confirmed the very negative view that I got of him when we were both at the Justice Department. He had the reputation of somebody who was always looking out for himself, trying to make sure that he came out ahead in all situations, and that seems to be what's going on here. The written statement that he released, you know, it almost seemed petty in ways. You know, he complained about having a dinner with the president about a week after inauguration, in which the president was talking to him about how he wanted people who were loyal to him, and he now says, he reacted negatively to that. Well, there's nothing unusual about that. There's certainly nothing unlawful about it. A president, of course, expects loyalty in his subordinates, and yet Comey is trying to paint this in some kind of nefarious fashion. The bottom line is this. There isn't a thing that Comey has said that in any way comes even marginally close to meeting the requirements of the federal statute on obstruction of justice. And as you know, that's the word, that's the phrase that's been bandied about.
A fair amount. And a few Democrats, too. And I'm sure there'll be more of it by the time this testimony is done. Let me ask you about his successor. Do you know anything about Christopher Wray, assuming he is confirmed by the Senate?
Yeah, I actually know Christopher Wray. We were at the Justice Department together. We were both lawyers down in Atlanta for a while. And what I can tell you about him is he's a very solid, very professional guy, has tremendous experience in the prosecution of criminal cases, actually much more so than the outgoing director of the FBI, Mr. Comey. And so I actually think he's going to do a very good job and hopefully repair the reputation of the FBI, which frankly Comey really damaged in his mishandling of not just this, but of the Clinton investigation.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one of the things that is very much in your wheelhouse, Hans von Spakovsky, namely the issue of illegal aliens and, you know, our laws with respect to keeping them out of the country in the first instance, and if they are in fact here illegally, getting them out of the country, particularly if they're engaged in any kind of criminal activity beyond being here illegally. You've written a recent piece on the subject, and I'd like to ask you to tie that in, if you would, to sort of this controversy underway at the moment about sanctuary cities as well.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that the president has really done where he's kept his promise is he has actually told the Department of Homeland Security to start enforcing our immigration laws. And you can see the results all over the country. There have been increased deportations. They have really made it a priority of going after criminal aliens. And this clearly has also deterred people from coming into the country. You know, the figures show that since he was inaugurated, there has been a huge drop in illegals trying to sneak across the southern border. So all of that shows that, in fact, this is a solvable problem. Now, there's a fight going on all over the country with so-called sanctuary cities saying that they are simply not going to comply with federal requirements. But even there, they have pushed ahead. I mean, despite the lawsuits against the Trump administration, Jeff Sessions just announced recently that he intended to fully go ahead with cutting off the eligibility of sanctuary cities to the discretionary law enforcement grants that the Justice Department hands out every year. And that's about $4 billion that they give out to cities and counties across the country.
Now, there have been complaints that that's the group that you least want impacted by the federal government's difficulties with the states in enforcing the law, or these cities. What are your thoughts on that, Hunt? Should, in fact, those funds be withheld, or should other funds that might otherwise flow to these cities be the target?
I don't think that argument is valid. If you're going to apply for a federal grant, you should certify, and that's what these cities have to do when they apply, that you are in compliance with federal law. And if instead you are actually obstructing the enforcement of federal immigration laws, you know, why in the world should you get that kind of money? I actually think Congress should think about passing laws that would go beyond these discretionary grants and start cutting off other kinds of funds to sanctuary cities.
Yeah, I agree with you. Let me ask you, Hans, about one other topic that, again, you've been deeply involved in for many years, and the Federal Election Commission, and also in your public policy work. This issue of voting fraud, it seems as though there is increasing evidence that it's real, and even some Democrats, I gather, are now agreeing that there should be a greater effort made to preserve the integrity of our voting system, not just from the Russians, mind you, but from fraudsters through, you know, voter IDs and so on. Give us an update on that, if you would, quickly.
Sure. Well, and let's relate to what we were just talking about that shows what a problem we have. Just about a week ago, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, I'm actually on the board, released a report about 5,500 non-citizens who were found on the voting rolls in the state of Virginia. Now, they were eventually removed by election officials, but 1,800 of them had cast something like 7,500 ballots. And this in a state where we've had two statewide AG's races in the last decade decided by less than 1,000 votes. We would never have known about it if it weren't for this group suing county governments to get this information. And the most important thing to know about this is that not only did these non-citizens illegally register and vote, they got away with it because even though election officials eventually took them off the rolls, they didn't forward any of that information to state or federal prosecutors for investigation and prosecution.
The numbers sound fairly small, but I guess what you're suggesting, if I can interpret it, Hans von Spakovsky, is this is symptomatic and almost certainly the tip of an iceberg if people simply had the wit and the will to look for it. Or better yet, these government agencies would actually be forthcoming with their data.
Yeah, in this particular case, these were all found by accident. It was people who admitted the second time they went back to DMV that, oh, I know I said I was a citizen before, but actually I'm not. So we don't know how many more non-citizens are out there on the rolls who have claimed to be citizens when they're not and have never admitted that. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. And this is the subject of your splendid book with John Fund, Who's Counting How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Thank you for participating with our program. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Giulio Miotti. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a distinct pleasure to be able to have with us for the first time, I believe, Giulio Miotti. He is the cultural editor for a national daily newspaper based in Rome, Il Foglio. He is also the author of a very important book, A New Shoah, The Untold Story of Israel's Victims of Terrorism, and even more to the point, a book known in Italian as La Fine dell'Europa, also known in English as The End of Europe, the subject of a very, very thought-provoking and, frankly, quite alarming new piece that he's written as a contributor to the Gatestone Institute entitled Are Jihadists Taking Over Europe? It's great to have him with us. Giulio, welcome. It's so good to have a chance to talk with you. It's been something I've aspired to do for a long time and glad to have a chance to do so with you now.
Good morning, Frank. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you, first of all, about this, well, recent revelation in Britain in the aftermath of the latest terrorist attack there that indicates that there may be as many as 23,000 jihadists that the British authorities are actively trying to monitor. You've introduced an even more staggering number of sort of the size of the problem on the continent as well. Would you talk about what's happening there and what it tells us about the gravity of the situation Europe is facing?
Well, the irony is that the German Chancellor Angela Merkel is now trying, according to some media reports, building a European army with the French government. But in fact, that is just a talk, because there is just one real army in Europe, and that is the jihadist army. According to the official statistics, there are about 23,000 Islamic extremists monitored by the British intelligence. The French authorities are monitoring 15,000 Muslim suprematists, let's say that. The Belgium, they have a terror watch list with about 20,000 people, and the German, they are monitoring 10,000 people. So according to these numbers, which are official lists, the four most targeted European countries by the Islamic State henchmen have about the 70,000 radical Muslims who are ready or not ready to take the weapons against their own countries.
Giulio, as you're thinking about this, I'm wondering whether you arrive at pretty much the same conclusion that I have, which is that what we're facing now in Europe, at least, and potentially in the not-too-distant future, even in the United States, is something in the nature of an insurgency rather than this problem, as we've described it, of terrorism, let alone just a few lone wolves.
Since 2004, since the Madrid bombings, the jihadists in Europe have been able to kill about 600 Europeans only on Europe's soil, not mention the terror attacks abroad in Tunisia, Mumbai, or other places, in Bangladesh. 600 people have been killed. But the most impressive is the frequency of these attacks. After the 9/11, there were the Madrid bombings 2 years later. 1 year later, there was the London bombings. Now we are seeing about the every month, every 3 weeks, a major attack. Let's count just in the last 6 months: Berlin, London, Stockholm, Paris, Manchester, London again. So In 2017, there have been about an attempt or succeed attack every 9 days in Europe. It's amazing, and because they are totally out of control. That's the problem. The Islamic State destroyed Palmyra in 2004. That's the most beautiful archaeological site in Syria. The Roman site. It was a treasure for humanity in the UNESCO's list. Since then, they moved the war against Western symbols in Europe and in the West. They attack parliaments in Ottawa, cafe in Copenhagen, beaches in Nice, social centers in San Bernardino, metros and airports in Brussels, music festival in Manchester and in Paris, theater restaurants in Paris, churches in northern France where they slaughter a price during the mass, Christmas markets in Berlin, malls in Stockholm. So it was not so bad for a JVU team, as Barack Obama shamefully called the caliphate, the Islamic State.
As you look at this, and again, our guest is Julio Meotti, a contributor to the Gatestone Institute and the cultural editor of Il Foglio, what do you make of the response from the leaders of the free world, such as it is, these nations most especially that you've mentioned that are being directly targeted, and the extent to which what they are doing so far is discouraging this insurgency, or is it actually simply enhancing its appetite for more jihad?
Let's see. These Islamists, these Muslim supremacists, have built this very powerful terror infrastructure inside the European cities. They have their own terror bases in the self-segregated multicultural enclaves, like the Tower Hamlets in London, the French banlieue in Paris, the Sharia Triangle in the Dutch capital of Den Haag. They get their weapons from the Balkans, where there are lots of weapons since the last civil war, and they can go there thanks to the Europe open borders, where they can travel with very easily. They get the money from abroad, from countries like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and other Islamic states, but they're also self-financing themselves. If you go to any Salafist mosque in France, you see everybody's asking for money to build a new mosque. And every week, two mosques are built in France, two Salafist mosques every week. That's the frequency. It's unbelievable. They get the human resources from this unvetted mass migration coming through the Mediterranean. And that's it's another very important chapter, since my country, Italy, is now at the front of this, you know, demographic revolution. In the last few days, 10,000 people came from Sahel and North Africa through Libya to Italy. And in the last 4 years, about 500,000 people reached Italy.
Their governments are, in part, it seems, allowing this to happen because not just of the phenomenon of the migrants coming and their growing confidence that they will prevail over their hosts, but in part, it seems, because of the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood and the subversion that it has been successfully engaged in inside governments on both sides of the Atlantic, it seems, as well. Would you just say a word about that?
Well, of course, because it's they decided after the 9/11, they decided to open the dialogue with the so-called official and institutional Muslim organization, the so-called moderate Islam, which is in fact the Islamist organization. Instead, they should have opened a dialogue with the Muslim dissidents like Ayaan Hirsi Ali and other very brave people who come from the Muslim world, and they are the real reformers, those who care about freedom of expression, gender equality, freedom of conscience, separation of mosque and state, pluralism, respect for the minorities and Christian and Yazidi and Jews. But they decided to, because they are fear, they are really fear. They They have been totally intimidated. They did nothing about them after the 9/11. They didn't shut down the Salafist radical mosque.
To the contrary, as you say, we've allowed them to proliferate dramatically. Julio, this is an extraordinarily important conversation, and I hope that we'll have a chance to continue it with you at greater length in the very near future. In the meantime, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the work you're doing now at the Gatestone Institute, as well as in your various books, including La Fina dell'Europa. I hope it will be translated for the benefit of all of us who need to know about what the end of Europe might mean and what it pretends, especially for us here in the United States. Thank you for your work, sir.
Thank you very much.
John Ligota, former FBI deep cover officer, joins us next. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a distinct pleasure to be able to have with us for the first time, I believe, Julio Meotti. He is the cultural editor for a national daily newspaper based in Rome, Il Foglio. He is also the author of a very important book, A New Shoah, The Untold Story of Israel's Victims of Terrorism, and even more to the point, a book known in Italian as La Fine dell'Europa, also known in English as The End of Europe, the subject of a very, very thought-provoking and, frankly, quite alarming new piece that he's written as a contributor to the Gatestone Institute entitled, Are Jihadists Taking Over Europe? It's great to have him with us. Julio, welcome. It's so good to have a chance to talk with you. It's been something I've aspired to do for a long time and glad to have a chance to do so with you now.
Good morning, Frank. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you, first of all, about this, well, recent revelation in Britain in the aftermath of the latest terrorist attack there that indicates that there may be as many as 23,000 jihadists that the British authorities are actively trying to monitor. You've introduced an even more staggering number of sort of the size of the problem on the continent as well. Would you talk about what's happening there and what it tells us about the gravity of the situation Europe is facing?
Well, the irony is that the German Chancellor Angela Merkel is now trying, according to some media reports, building a European army with the French government, but in fact, it's just a talk, because there is just one real army in Europe, and that is the jihadist army. According to the official statistics, there are about 23,000 Islamic extremists monitored by the British intelligence. The French authorities are monitoring 15,000 Muslim suprematists, let's say that. The Belgium, they have a terror watch list with about 20,000 people, and the German, they are monitoring 10,000 people. So according to these numbers, which are official lists, the four most targeted European countries by the Islamic State henchmen have about the 70,000 radical Muslims who are ready or not ready to take the weapons against their own countries.
Julio, as you're thinking about this, I'm wondering whether you arrive at pretty much the same conclusion that I have, which is that what we're facing now in Europe, at least, and potentially in the not-too-distant future, even in the United States, is something in the nature of an insurgency, rather than this problem, as we've described it, of terrorism, let alone just a few lone wolves.
Since 2004, since the Madrid bombings, the jihadists in Europe have been able to kill about 600 Europeans only on Europe's soil, not mention the terror attacks abroad in Tunisia, Mumbai, or other places, in Bangladesh. 600 people have been killed. But the most impressive is the frequency of these attacks. After the 9/11, there were the Madrid bombings 2 years later. 1 year later, there was the London bombings. Now we are seeing about the every month, every 3 weeks, a major attack. Let's count just in the last 6 months, Berlin, London, Stockholm, Paris, Manchester, London again. So in 2017, there have been about an attempt or succeed attack every 9 days in Europe. It's amazing, and because they are totally, it's totally out of control. That's the problem. The Islamic State destroyed Palmyra in 2004. That's the most beautiful archaeological site in Syria. The Roman site, it was a treasure for humanity in the UNESCO's list. Since then, they moved the war against Western symbols in Europe and in the West. They attack parliaments in Ottawa, cafe in Copenhagen, beaches in Nice, social centers in San Bernardino, metros and airports in Brussels, music festival in Manchester and in Paris, theater restaurants in Paris, churches in northern France where they slaughter a price during the mass, Christmas markets in Berlin, malls in Stockholm. So it was not so bad for a JV team, as Barack Obama shamefully called the caliphate, the Islamic State.
As you look at this, and again, our guest is Julio Meotti, a contributor to the Gatestone Institute and the cultural editor of Il Foglio. What do you make of the response from the leaders of this free world, such as it is, these nations most especially that you've mentioned that are being directly targeted, and the extent to which what they are doing so far is discouraging this insurgency, or is it actually simply enhancing its appetite for more jihad?
Let's see. These Islamists, these Muslim supremacists, have built this very powerful terror infrastructure inside the European cities. They have their own terror bases in the self-segregated multicultural enclaves, like the Tower Hamlets in London, the French banlieue in Paris, the Sharia Triangle in the Dutch capital of Den Haag. They get their weapons from the Balkans, where there are lots of weapons since the last civil war, and they can go there thanks to the Europe open borders, where they can travel with very easily. They get the money from abroad, from countries like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and other Islamic states, but they're also self-financing themselves. If you go to any Salafist mosque in France, you see everybody's asking for money to build a new mosque. And every week, two mosques have built in France, two Salafist mosques every week. That's the frequency. It's unbelievable. They get the human resources from this unvetted mass migration coming through the Mediterranean. And that's it's another very important chapter, since my country, Italy, is now at the front of this, you know, demographic revolution. In the last few days, 10,000 people came from Sahel and North Africa through Libya to Italy. And in the last 4 years, about 500,000 people reached Italy.
Their governments are, in part, it seems, allowing this to happen because not just of the phenomenon of the migrants coming and their growing confidence that they will prevail over their hosts, but in part, it seems, because of the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood and the subversion that it has been successfully engaged in inside governments on both sides of the Atlantic, it seems, as well. Would you just say a word about that?
Well, of course, because it's they decided after the 9/11, they decided to open the dialogue with the so-called official and institutional Muslim organization, the so-called moderate Islam, which is in fact the Islamist organization. Instead, they should have opened a dialogue with the Muslim dissidents like Ayaan Hirsi Ali and other very brave people who come from the Muslim world, and they are the real reformers, those who care about freedom of expression, gender equality, freedom of conscience, separation of mosque and state, pluralism, respect for the minorities and Christian and Yazidi and Jews. But they decided to, because they are fear, they are really fear. They have been totally intimidated. They did nothing about it after the 9/11. They didn't shut down the Salafist radical mosque.
To the contrary, as you say, we've allowed them to proliferate dramatically. Julio, this is an extraordinarily important conversation, and I hope that we'll have a chance to continue it with you at greater length in the very near future. In the meantime, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the work you're doing now at the Gatestone Institute, as well as in your various books, including La Fina dell'Europa. I hope it will be translated for the benefit of all of us who need to know about what the end of Europe might mean and what it pretends, especially for us here in the United States. Thank you for your work, sir.
Thank you very much.
John Ligota, former FBI deep cover officer, joins us next. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.